Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today's guest speaker will be Charles Villavicencio, a senior research fellow in the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation in Cape Town, South Africa, and author of Walk With Us and Listen, Political Reconciliation in Africa. He'll speak on the topic, Violence, Religion, Financial Muscle, and Liberation, Can Africa Heal Itself? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 17, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the sponsors of the E.N. Thompson Forum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Lloyd Ambrosius, Samuel Clark Waugh Distinguished Professor of International Relations and a Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
Charles Villavicencio is a theologian and political scientist. He is a specialist on reconciliation and peacemaking after civil wars or civil conflicts with extensive experience as a consultant in African countries and also in Peru. He served in the late 1990s as the National Director of Research for the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, working with Archbishop Desmond Tutu in that process of transition from apartheid to democracy in South Africa. Now he divides his time between his home country of South Africa, where he's a senior research fellow at the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation, which he founded in 2000 in Cape Town, and the other half of the time in Washington, D.C., where he is a visiting professor dealing with conflict resolution on the faculty at Georgetown University. Now join me in welcoming Professor Charles Villavicencio to the podium.
I'm delighted. It's a privilege to be with you and to be trying to make sense of this rather complicated title that I've given this particular lecture, Violence, Religion, Financial Muscle, and Freedom, because all these things are intertwined. The question is, can Africa heal itself? I want to begin by sharing with you two quotations. The first one comes from the latter part of the 19th century and the height of the British Empire in South Africa and other parts of Africa. Just ponder these words for a moment. Onward, Christian soldiers, onto heathen lands, prayer books in your hands. Take the glorious tidings where trade can be done. Spread the peaceful gospel with the Maxim gun. Tell the rested natives, sinful are their hearts. Turn their heathen temples into spirit marts. And if to your teaching they will not succumb, give them another sermon with the Maxim gun. Words that go back to the Matabele Wars of the latter part of the century. Let me give you another one. We must face the matter squarely, said President Mandela, that where there is something wrong in how we govern ourselves, it must be said that the fault is not in our stars, but in ourselves. We know that we have it in ourselves as Africans to change all this. We must assert our will to do so. We must say that there is no obstacle big enough to stop us from bringing about an African renaissance. These two quotations, extending from the height of colonialism through to the more recent discovery and grasping of democracy in South Africa, and more generally what is referred to as the African Renaissance, sets the stage for what I shall endeavor to say tonight. Colonialism, which began with the Maxim gun and the prayer book in the hand, is widely regarded in Africa as the continent's Holocaust. And so Joseph Conrad, in his celebrated Heart of Darkness, can end that amazing story with the words, "Exterminate the brutes." I begin with a very brief outline or description of colonialism in Africa. Approximately 10,000 African kingdoms were reduced to 40 states by Africa's would-be masters in the Berlin Conference of 1884-1885, where African land was parceled out without regard to kith, kin, tribe, ethnicity, monarchies, chiefdoms, language, culture, or religion. It was divided and handed out to European masters. The map on the conference table included large sections of that land, which was simply designated terra incognita, with boundaries between colonies being decreed, in many instances, by the drawing of geometric lines or the tracing of rivers, tearing apart clans and communities and rendering nations incomplete. To understand the contemporary history of Africa, we've got to consider the growth of colonialism. British colonialism, of course, is exemplified nowhere more brutally than in the Battle of Abdurrahman on the 2nd of September, 1898, when General Kitchener captured Khartoum in what has been described by some historians as the last full cavalry charge of British history and the first use of the Maxim gun. He managed to slaughter 10,000 Sudanese soldiers and left another 1,600 wounded. When the battle was over, the tough but loyal Kitchener wept in gratitude for the price that his troops had paid. He demanded that the Union Jack be raised, and he asked his troops to give 3 cheers for Queen Victoria and instructed the regimental band to play "Abide With Me." The empire, of course, under Queen Victoria, had grown enormously during her reign, and by the time her reign ended, it had been extended over a further 3.5 million square miles throughout or around the globe, including the larger part of Africa. The next stop, of course, for the colonial forces after their exploits in Sudan were in the South African Boer Republics. You may recall that the estimation of British politicians that this was a war that would be all over in a few months. It endured for 3 years. Again, there was the Maxim gun. And the irony is that some of those early missionaries who had come to South Africa from Britain and elsewhere to proclaim the gospel to the heathen, now left their flock and they went off to join the British forces, sometimes raising a gun, on other occasions carrying the prayer book. That war endured, and Boer guerrilla forces were ultimately beaten in submission through a scorched earth policy by the British forces that saw 28,000 Boer women and children die in concentration camps, and a further 14,000 African servants interned in separate camps in this so-called white man's war. That is the story of colonialism. It's the story of the gun. It's the story of the missionary. The upside of Abderrahman and the Anglo-Boer War, or the South African War as it eventually came to be called, was in fact a dramatic shift in British politics against colonial warmongering, with Emily Hobhouse and others taking the lead with suffragettes in England to put an end to the notion of a concentration camp. Needless to say, she never succeeded. And very soon that optimistic moment of ending colonial exploitation and bloodshed gave way to the First World War, and the bloodshed began again. But let me add one more word concerning colonialism. The suffering in Africa extended beyond the colonial period. And as we move into the era of African independence, there were those neo-African leaders and politicians who were as exploitative of their own people as the colonialists had ever been. Hence the comment by Nelson Mandela: the fault, dear friends, is not in the stars. It's not exclusively in the colonial period. It's we who have taken this upon ourselves. And so I ask you to recall the Berlin Conference of 1884, where Africa was parceled out to those who would have it. But I want to talk to you a little bit tonight about two things in Africa which we cannot ignore and cannot put aside. The one is the state of the African economy, and the other one is African governance. These are the two elephants in the room, and one cannot do an analysis of the African predicament without addressing these. You know, 60% of the undeveloped land in the world today is in Africa. There are vast reserves of coal and oil and various minerals waiting to be tapped. There are some who have in recent days suggested that Africa has the potential to come to the world what your country, the United States, was earlier in the last century. And there are some remarkable stories of progress on the economic front in Africa, places like Ghana, where oil has now been discovered, Libya, and so on. But the defining characteristic of African economies is the huge, yawning, and growing gap between the rich and the poor. I came across an interesting statistic only the other day that I'm told that the Chinese have discovered that the Gini coefficient of their country is 42. And they have identified for themselves the rising inequality in their country as a source of major social threat and unrest. I quote that to you only so that I may point out that the Gini coefficient in South Africa is not 42, it's 60, which has provoked some in South Africa economists and others to suggest that South Africa will have its Tunisia day by 2020. We've got to talk about the economy. We've also got to talk about African governance. And I think it is here that Africa has made some remarkable progress in the institution, the establishment of the African Union, which seeks to hold African countries accountable not only to their own people, but to one another, people who are part of that African Union. And so in terms of African economy and African governance, there is a long and a sad story. There are also signals of hope. But as I said to you, I want to talk about a few other things in a little more depth. I want to talk to you about those so-called soft dimensions of who Africans are. And I pose the question, just who are these African people who have been exploited through colonialism and who have exploited themselves through corrupt governance and an inability to drive an economy? Africa is an interesting continent. There are those who join vigorously in the Africa-Arab debate, asking whether an African can be an Arab and whether an Arab can be an African. In my own country, there has been a spirited debate as to who is this white tribe of Africa. And we could continue. What is the relationship between Arabs and Berbers and Bantu-speaking Africans? Just when and can a settler ever become a native? I'm going to turn this question on its head and ask the question, why is it that Africans, in many instances, so readily appropriate, imbibe, internalize, take upon themselves a colonial or a European identity rather than to cling to their roots? Speaking at a Gori Island conference a little while ago, a South African author who some of you will recognize his name, Breyten Breytenbach, focused on the need to discern and to understand the values that give shape and identity and form to the African people. He asked somewhat provocatively, in whose borrowed clothes are these Africans, especially elite Africans, seeking to live? Is this willingness to borrow and to appropriate the values from colonialists a negative or a potentially a positive ingredient? How does colonialism, global realities, African politics, and the talk of an African Renaissance, how does this make sense? And what does it mean? I this evening want to address, just in a little more depth, three topics in relation to who is an African internally, in the depths of his or her soul. And the first topic I would like to address is the issue of language and culture. You know, the African access to the benefits of settlers and missionaries and colonial authorities was primarily through their ability to become efficient in the colonial tongue or language. So if you wanted to succeed as an African, if you wanted to benefit from those resources that the colonial government was offering, you better get to speak English or French or German or Italian or Portuguese and, to a limited extent, Dutch and eventually Afrikaans. That was your gateway in. And there are many African poets, writers, musicians and artists who have acquired an exceptional ability in the so-called colonial tongue. They are the products of religious missionaries who came to Africa and offered a certain kind of education. But this access to the colonial tongue, of course, separated them from the so-called unschooled Africans who did not go to school. And some have found that it was these mission-educated African people over against the non-mission-educated Africans that created this huge gulf in African identity and politics. The question was, and the question is, whether those African leaders versed in the colonial tongue and ability could in any way relate to that group of people who the English social critics once referred to as the great unwashed. There's been fierce debate amongst African scholars, especially in recent years, as to what the responsibility is of those elite in relation to the uneducated masses. And one of the most interesting developments, and let me really delve a little bit into South African history over here, one of the most interesting developments in literary circles is this. There are those younger black African scholars who are beginning to question the revered Sophiatown Renaissance, a process of resistance within which people like Mandela shared. And you remember that, if you know anything of the South African history, that one of the most famous literary outputs of the period, one of the most famous media outputs of the period, was Drum Magazine, written in English. And these young scholars, in a very politically incorrect way, if you like, are beginning to argue that the fact of the Sophiatown Renaissance, Drum Magazine, being written in the educated tongue of the colonial master was what undermined the ability of ordinary Africans, grassroots Africans, some of whom were uneducated Africans in terms of our notion of education, whether this was not oppressing them. And should we not reject the notion of the Sophiatown Renaissance? Should we not reject the elitism of those scholars so that the poor at the bottom of the pile can emerge and begin to express themselves? This is a quest, according to these young scholars, for African identity to rediscover itself and to emerge as a formative influence. And this, of course, immediately takes us to the next issue which I want to raise, and that is religion. This education, this elitism, this language, this culture of the elite was communicated to the great unwashed through religious missionaries. What is the role of religion in Africa today? Let me put aside the theory for a moment and just share with you three anecdotes about religion in Africa. The first anecdote concerns a movement that emerged in the mid-70s that called for the rejection of foreign missionaries. I remember as a young and tender young white boy from South Africa, and my first venture into Kenya to attend a World Council of Churches program to combat racism meeting. And there I met the great John Gatu. John Gatu was the head of the Presbyterian Church in that part of the world, and he called for a moratorium on all missionaries. He said, it's the missionaries who have come to us, imposing upon us colonial values. We need to ask them to go home. He said we need at least 5 years to discover who we are as African Christians. This was a position that was adopted by the All Africa Conference of Churches. It was in continuity with the cry of Ghana's first president, namely Kwame Nkrumah, who insisted, and I quote, "Seek ye first the political kingdom, and all else will be added unto you." Well, the truth of the matter is, nobody really listened to my dear friend John Gatu, and missionaries kept coming. In fact, the world was outraged by the cry of the All Africa Conference of Churches, and President Nkrumah was rejected as some sort of Marxist atheist nut. There were great theologians of the West, including Bishop Stephen Neill, who accused the African church of losing all sense of direction. There were other spokespersons for the so-called European church, like Peter Beierhaus and others, who came out with the Frankfurt Declaration, scathing assessment of the role of the churches, and called upon Christians to focus exclusively on spiritual salvation through Christ and Christ alone. There were others who took a more moderate position. Not least, there was John Scott and his colleagues who produced the Lucerne Statement that said, this talk of syncretism, this talk of God communicating in him, and we might add herself, through Christianity alone and through a colonial notion of Christianity has got to be rejected, because salvation comes through Christ and Christ alone. In brief, mission activity continued while there were some in Africa calling for the rejection of all forms of colonial or European Christianity. It was rejected, and there was an unbelievable growth of foreign-funded missions throughout Africa. I wish I could take you on a car trip with me as you drive the road from Entebbe in the south, up north through Uganda's rural sugarcane farms, and on the way somebody will show you where Idi Amin had people shot and buried. But en route you will encounter one after the other a proliferation of boards pointing to evangelical seminaries, schools, creches, clinics, hospitals, and rehabilitation centers. And the government of Uganda, the same as the government of many other African countries, is today looking to those missions to provide the kind of social services they can't provide for themselves. I, in one of those memorable moments as I was traveling in that part, had conversation with a very enthusiastic young Ugandan pastor and his staff at a mission hospital outside of Kampala. And he passionately told me, you've got to believe in Christ and Christ alone. And as I recall his words, they were so similar to words that the first missionaries must have spoken on many occasions. I remember this young pastor putting his hand on my shoulder and saying, "Body and soul, my brother, body and soul. You can't have the one without the other. That's what the gospel is all about." Well, some of those missions are funded by very conservative, big money churches with their roots in your country, the United States, and in various parts of Europe. And so as they offer the gospel, they offer certain values and certain perceptions and certain ideals that one would, in some instances, want to question. But I don't want to dwell there. I think what we need to say is this. The judging from the response of this particular pastor and the growth of theological conservative Christians in Africa, whether they are funded with big money or not, I suggest there is a tendency amongst many academics to socially rationalize or explain away the spiritual belief of Africans, to underestimate it. Now, the great sociologist Max Weber and others identified the connection between belief and prosperity. Many of those mission churches in Africa, whether you agree with them or not, are churches that are focusing on spiritual transformation as a way towards health and prosperity and riches and the good life. Work is still waiting to be done on the spiritual dimension of Africans and how they relate this to the secular dimensions of life. Spiritual healing, the prosperity gospel, gender politics, sexual orientations, all include religious dimensions. And if these are not dealt with and if these are not debated within the African continent, then I want to suggest that many of these issues will not be resolved to the satisfaction of African people. And so, I've given you two models of Christianity in Africa. On the one hand, the call for a moratorium on all missionaries. Please go home for 5 years. Give us a chance to find ourselves. This was as recently as the mid-70s, 1970s. And on the other hand, diametrically opposed, if you like, is this growth of evangelical churches throughout the African continent that seeks to link spiritual healing to well-being and to prosperity. I leave it there. I don't want to say which one is right. The debate is still on. I want to refer to a third model, and that is the secular and religious renewal that has taken place in South Africa. This third anecdote that I share with you involves a South African quest, an attempt to understand this big word called reconciliation. It is that word which is rooted in what Professor Curry earlier referred to as Ubuntu, that African belief that I am through you and you are through me. And to the extent that there's enmity between you and me, I am a lesser person and you are a lesser person. This was an inclusive vision. And I remember so clearly as South Africa moved from its very closed and rigid neo-Calvinist type of approach to religion through apartheid to a more open and secular approach, there was great anxiety in South Africa. The amazing thing is that before South Africa adopted its new constitution, and let me say this to you, a constitution
that does not refer to the word God, other than in one short phrase, that says, "And may God protect our people." This was a moment when the religious groups of South Africa came together, Christians and Muslims and Jews and Baha'i faith and Hindus and Buddhists came together and said, we have got to create a country and a constitution that allows space for all of us. So we're not telling the missionaries to go home. Neither are we going to allow the missionaries to dominate the social services. We're going to say that all religions and all cultures are equal under a single constitution. So energized. You know, that's a word I've learnt since I'm back in America in this last month. There's always some political party energizing the base. Well, South Africa was energized around this notion of a state that would include all religions and all cultures, showing no favor towards any. So energized was it that there were those who were deeply, deeply concerned when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was established and Archbishop Tutu was the chair of the commission. There was particular concern that Archbishop Tutu usually wore his clerical garb. And in the beginning, he would open each session with a prayer. Well, there were those of us in the commission who spoke with Archbishop, and he agreed that from time to time he would wear ordinary secular dress. And he also said that instead of opening with a prayer, there would be a moment of silence so that everybody could communicate with his or her understanding of the divine without him imposing words from within the Christian tradition. It was an interesting debate. And I remember at the time saying to the media who spoke to me about this all, I said, you know, if you want Archbishop Tutu as the chairperson of this commission, you know who you're going to get? You're going to get Archbishop Tutu. That's who he is. That's his identity. And you're not going to extract him from that tradition in which he stands. But it was that initiative by religious movements in association with a newly elected democratic government that gave rise to this intervention, a brave intervention, called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You know, at the time, South Africa faced three options. Apartheid was over, but people remembered the atrocities of the past. And the question was, what do we do about those responsible for those atrocities? There were three options. The one was to have a blanket or general amnesty and say to people, well, the past is past, and God bless you, you can all go your way, there will be no prosecutions. This option was rejected because the poorest of the poor and those who were violated most found it very, very difficult to simply close the door on the past. Someone said at the time, those who have suffered least are somehow blessed with a good memory, but those who have suffered most are cursed with a memory, and they cannot put it aside. So that amnesty possibility was rejected. The other option was to have trials or prosecutions, and the word Nuremberg and Tokyo trials was bandied about. The problem was that in South Africa, where we had a negotiated settlement, there was absolutely no way that the military and security forces of apartheid would lay down their guns if they knew tomorrow or in 6 months' time they would have their day in court and probably spend the rest of their time in prison. And so amnesty was out in that blanket form. Trials and prosecutions was out. It was not a political possibility. And this gave birth to the notion of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Necessity, we are told, is the mother of invention. And so South Africans sat down, and the newly elected, democratically elected government said there should be a Truth Commission. This will involve a two and a half, three-year national conversation where we will invite those who've suffered most to come forward and tell their stories. And we will offer those who were the perpetrators the option of conditional amnesty, that if they come and tell their story, acknowledge their crimes under cross-examination before a panel of judges and are judged to be telling the truth, they will receive amnesty. But it was conditional upon them acknowledging their failures, confessing their sins, if you like. Well, there were those who were skeptical about this. Let me just briefly report to you that 22,000 victims volunteered to come forward and tell their story. If we allowed each one of them to do so in public, I suppose that commission would still be sitting. So we took a sample of approximately 10%. 2,000 people of those 22 who had submitted an affidavit, we asked them to come and tell their stories. And for 2.5 years, South Africans listened to the stories of those who suffered most. The attempt was to create a cathartic moment where people could remember and deal with their past. And it didn't happen in some, it didn't succeed 100%. But there were many who were able to put the past behind them and move on. I remember on the day that we handed the report in, the end of 1998, to Mr. Mandela, who was the president at the time, a young cheeky journalist coming, sticking a microphone under my nose. He said to me, "Well, Professor, have you guys reconciled the nation?" And I knew this young man quite well. He was a good fellow. And I said to him, "You know, my friend, that's the stupidest question I've heard anybody ask in the last 3 years. You don't heal a nation in 3 years. But we have created a space within which we can begin to address those issues." What about the perpetrators? You know, approximately 7,000 people applied for amnesty as perpetrators. In the end, less than 1,200, to be precise, 1,167 people were granted amnesty. The others were denied amnesty. So it wasn't just an automatic blanket amnesty. If you roll up, you got it, kid, you can go home. People had to come. They had to acknowledge. They had to tell their story. They could be cross-examined. They could be questioned by their victims. What was the purpose of the commission? It was to say, let us come together as people, different people, black and white, perpetrators and victims, Jews and Christians and Muslims and Baha'is and everybody else, let's come together and let's find one another so that we can create a new and a better South Africa. Let me leave that there, and needless to say, I could speak about the Truth Commission all night. It wasn't perfect. There were many, many faults. But it got South Africa over a crucial moment in its history where people of different cultures, different religions, different colors, different ideological beliefs came together and said, let's build a nation. There was a religious root there, a moral identity there, an African flavor there, which was different
very different from that notion of reject all missionaries to, yes, let's bring in the conservative churches and let them sort us out. It was no. We will come together as a people of different faiths and take it from there. So I think African identity does have something to do with culture and language. It has something to do with religion. The last comment I want to make on this identity thing is the issue of nation building. And here I need to move on before I'm told that my time is up. You know, the basic characteristic of colonialism was this, that the colonial settlers were governed according to civil law. The African groups were governed according to customary law. And settlers were seen to be one homogeneous group of people with all the protection, human rights, etc., that was embedded in international law. Africans were governed according to customary law. And each separate African clan or tribe had a separate customary law. And as colonialism went on, the colonists made sure that the chiefs and the leaders of each one of those cultural groups were somebody with whom they could work, with whom they could do business, who would be supportive of them in return for them being supportive of the chiefs. Now the name Mahmud Mamdani may mean something to you. He's an African scholar, a Ugandan, and he has suggested that the root of the conflict that we experience in South Africa today can be traced back to that notion of customary law. And so even at the time of independence, as political leaders began to emerge in the African communities, who did they look to for support? Those who were around them, the people of their tribe, the people of their culture, the people of their clan. And this, he says, has been embedded in the post-colonial period. And so when we look at some of the worst atrocities in Africa, what do we see? Rwanda, Hutus against Tutsis, Tutsis against Hutus. Or take the conflicts that we experience in Nigeria today. Or take the conflict between the North and the South, the Muslim North and the so-called Christian and indigenous believers of the South in Sudan. Or come closer home and look at the conflict in Zimbabwe between the Matabele and the Shona. In each case, these are groups within who look to their own and fight against the other within their own national borders. I think South Africa, for all its limitations, and God knows for all its failures, and we've seen it most recently with regards to the dreadful incidents in the Marikana mines and elsewhere, South Africa has created a constitution that is above all religions, all cultural groups, all tribal groups, all clan groups, and say, we're all equal. Now, we haven't quite got there, have we? We are still trapped in the memories of the past. We struggle to understand what it means to be a South African with roots in a Xhosa tradition or the Tswana tradition or the Zulu tradition or the English tradition or the Afrikaner tradition. We're still struggling. But that constitution, that aspiration, that goal is there, which I want to suggest means that South Africa
is quite different, at least at the theoretical constitutional level, to perhaps any other country on the African continent. We struggle to live together. Hey, but then so do you, don't you? I've been intrigued in these last weeks. You see, you are here. I come from the outside and I look with new eyes. And I listen to these fears that, you know, this may be the last election where Caucasian Americans have this sort of dominance, because the Hispanic group is beginning to grow. And there are African Americans and there are people from Southeast Asia and all the rest of it. How do you learn to live together? Let me go back to one sentence from Mamdani, when he says there's got to be a new paradigm of what do we mean by nation, which embraces all the pieces that cause people to be separate. He said, you can have a revolution, you can have independence, maybe he would say you can even have a presidential election. And you can turn the world upside down, but still fail to change it. You can turn the world upside down, but still fail to change it. So I'm back to the question with which I began. How do Africans heal themselves? Can Africa heal itself? If I look at the colonial period and if I look at global politics today, I say to you, if Africa can't heal itself, well, then Africa's not going to be healed, because nobody else is going to do it for us. We've got to find a way to move forward. And to this end, I want to close this presentation with three questions, which I ask you to ponder. That's all the professors can do, is raise questions. Students are the ones that have got to answer it. The first one concerns global economics. And I want to ask, is there a realistic option for narrowing the economic gap between first world and peripheral economies around the world? Economic equality in African countries is in bad shape. But can this be redressed without, in some way, tackling global economics head on? Because what you see in third world countries, in the gap between the rich and the poor, is just a concentrated version of what you see in global politics between first and third world countries. My next question is the transformation of dissident states. I've sketched a fairly optimistic vision, without suggesting we're there, but a vision that we can live together through the African Union on the continent, through a constitution such as we have it in South Africa. But what do you do with dissident states? What do you do with those states who won't come to the party and who won't stop exploiting their own people and disregarding international human rights values? What do you do with them? These countries claim sovereign independence. When does a nation have a right to intervene? When does a nation have an obligation to intervene in another nation? When does the world have an obligation to protect the people of Zimbabwe or Sudan or Syria or elsewhere in the Middle East? When does that moment come? We have certain rules and regulations through the international community and through the United Nations, but at a political level, when do you intervene? When are wars of intervention ever valid? Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and now Syria, Zimbabwe, and many other places. The third and the final question I ask is it realistic to look at the South African way of dealing with a very conflictual past that didn't demand that President de Klerk and Botha before him and all sorts of other people who probably deserved their day in prison to be exempted? Or look at Zimbabwe. What a dreadful situation. But can I tell you something? That Ian Smith, the guy who was responsible for the mess that Zimbabwe landed itself in and that Mugabe inherited, Ian Smith was never prosecuted. In fact, he could walk through the streets of Harare and go into the supermarket and do his shopping. What is this African thing? This Ubuntu thing? Does it make sense? Is it an alternative to wars of intervention? What is it? And here's my final question. Is there an African notion and a South African notion of dealing with the past through restorative justice as opposed to retributive or punitive justice, which I think is the hallmark of justice as you know it in your country, as European countries know it, as the First World knows it? There's an option to intervene. No. Does this mean to isolate yourself, to put up the barriers and say, let the world go to where the world will go, we will protect our own? No. The question is, what does the obligation to protect mean? Is it restorative? Does it heal? And in that context, I end where I began. Can Africa heal itself? We have a long history of trying to do so. We have not come up with a perfect answer. But you know what? Neither is the rest of the world. Thank you for your attention.
You've been listening to a program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today's guest speaker was Charles Villavicencio, a senior research fellow in the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation in Cape Town, South Africa, and author of Walk With Us and Listen, Political Reconciliation in Africa. He spoke on the topic, Violence, Religion, Financial Muscle, and Liberation, Can Africa Heal Itself? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 17, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Katie Cervantes, E.N. Thompson Forum Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.